Hey, thanks for dropping by. Come on in.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
Tonight in the drawing room, we're going to talk to a couple of women about the intersections of race, of colonialism, and of storytelling. One of the women you'll hear comes from Broome. The other was born and raised in Zimbabwe. That storytelling is intrinsic to the work that both of them do. Dahlia Pigram is a founding member and co-artistic director of the Aboriginal dance company Murugeku. She's in Melbourne at the moment for the premiere of her latest work, Gudu Gudu. She joins me in the drawing room now. Thanks for coming in.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is Fadzai Jaravaza, who's the founder of Stillwaters, a storytelling collective of women of African descent that's housed at the Institute of Postcolonial Studies in North Melbourne. Fadzai, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So you're both storytellers. What drew you to this? Did you have a choice about it?
I don't think so, because it's so much a part of our culture, storytelling, and through dance, song, listening to Bugariara, things that are from the time before us, that are part of our cultures and our ancestors we have to bring with us forward. So it's very much a part of everything I do, even as a mother.
Yeah, well, especially as a mother.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that mothers all around the world have to do is tell lots and lots of stories.
Yeah.
Why is it? What's so significant about stories, do you think, in human development and then social development?
Well, I think I've always been pretty curious about the way that my parents grew up, because we're so different from the way that I grew up, having been raised in the city, so coming very much from a very hybrid culture, but more Western, I think, influence than what my parents would have had.
Where were you
and
born?
My grandparents in Zimbabwe.
Right.
So my grandparents would have been the first generation that was colonized, and I was born just as colonization ended. So for me, hearing those stories from my parents about the liberation struggle, hearing those stories from my grandparents about how they used to live, you know, and how different that was and contrasted with the way I lived in a brick house in the city with cars, you know, very much a Western lifestyle. Yeah.
Air conditioning,
you know. Yeah. So very different.
It's interesting, though, because when we think, and this is quite possibly just a product of ignorance, but when we think about Indigenous storytelling in Australia, we don't think about stories to do with colonization. We think of stories that are much more folkish, I suppose. But there must be these stories out there. Is it just that we don't hear them?
I think, you know, the legacies that have been left for us by past policies and things like that have influenced which stories we tell. And the stories, as a company, Marigeku, we decide to tell are the here and now kind of stories, and the way that we're dealing with some of those legacies that have left are left for us a pathway to find new forms of storytelling and on multi-layered kind of structures. In you know, when we're looking at a show, we could be telling a story to communicate to someone who has lived the life of a traditional person in our culture, or we could be telling non-initiated young men and women that would see things differently, or urban audiences or whatnot. And so we try to connect to everyone through, you know, the art of moving through dance, and to let the movement speak for the story sometimes. But a lot of the time our work is very multi-layered, to try and tap into or try to communicate to many different people with our type of storytelling.
Well, tell us about the story that you're currently working on.
Gurir Gurir is a more personal sort of story, and it's sort of a reflection on the concerns I have for my community at the moment, not just Broome but the Kimberley region. In many ways, things are going to change quite significantly in the next little while. And Gurir Gurir is a small little shorebird that calls to tell you that the tide is going to turn. And one of my grandfathers related this function of that bird in our culture with the work that I do with Marigeku and keeping language alive in my community. I was unfortunately not brought up to know my language because of those past policies and the fear of being taken away and things like that. So for the last 10 years I've had the privilege to learn from one of our last remaining speakers, of fluent speakers of our language, from her firsthand, to then transfer that knowledge to the young people at school level, you know. And you know, the time is right now. We have to act on these issues right now. And in my way, I try to transfer those concerns through the artwork. So with Gurirgurir, it's looking at the way that metaphorically the tide is turning for our community. For instance, losing culture and language if we're not careful. Also the very high suicide rates for young people in our community. The Kimberley region holds one of the highest suicide rates in the world.
Mm. What are you doing with that? Are you explaining why? Are you asking questions about it? What are you doing?
I guess I'm just putting it out there to try and shine a light on the issue. I definitely don't want to feel like I'm educating anyone on the issue because I know nothing about it. My head does not think like that. Mm. But I have empathy, I have sympathy, I have all of those things for many family members and others that have had to go through things in that realm. And yeah, it's sort of a bit of a journey for myself to try and understand it and why, because there's many different reasons, obviously, that could lead to someone feeling that that's the last resort.
Fadzai, the stories are different, I imagine, and even the histories, although there'd be parallels, are different. But are there resonances in what you're hearing Dahlia say then?
Yeah, there definitely are some parallels around culture, around language, and around policies that have basically robbed people like me of the ability to speak fluently to the elders in my own language, and in that respect, to be able to tell story in my own language as well, because you lose that understanding of the idioms. Mm. And also when you're not on the land itself, when you're raised in, let's say, like a city, and you're not on the land, a lot of those idioms don't make sense. They're
right.
Very much related to the season. So, you know,
can you give us an example?
You know, so for instance, there's a saying that sometimes you need to leave things to the people who best know how to handle it. And it's kugocha kunodakwa mai. Which is a mother is the best person to roast mealies. A child would just put out the fire. So you listen to that, you go, what? What is that?
That means
mean?
Absolutely nothing.
Like, that
yeah.
means nothing, you know yeah. what I mean? But it's the whole process of knowing how to light a fire and knowing when to put the maize on it. And, you know, so it's just saying there's techniques and skills to things that somebody who's older and wiser, because they've got the experiential wisdom, not necessarily the I've seen it, I know how to do it, but I've actually done it, and I've done it so many times
It's not
now.
Textbook knowledge. It's
exactly.
a different kind of knowledge.
It's a different kind of knowledge.
What you say, though, raises a really interesting question about the survival of culture, where the relationship between culture and language is somehow broken. Can those things be revived? Does it necessarily mean that the culture that is to come in following generations is going to be some kind of emaciated form of culture? Will it be something equally rich and new? What are the consequences of that?
I think that's a really massive question, and I think it's one that's very difficult to answer, and I can only give my own personal opinion. And that is, I struggled with this for a long time. I felt like I had been cut off. I felt like I had something taken, stolen away from me, until I realized that the way that we live is a form of culture. And I think it's finding that culture in your day-to-day, even if you know, like we're a hybrid, basically. You are a hybrid, and it's about embracing that. It's about embracing living between and at the intersection of a lot of different cultural influences.
And but do you see that as something exciting and new, or as something lost?
I see it as something that has always happened now. And the reason why I say that is when I look into the history of migration within Africa, and you realize that migration's been going on for so long, and that my people actually displaced indigenous people, but did it in processes where they actually took up aspects of that indigenous culture and the language and totem and all this sort of stuff, but bringing their own influences as well. Then you start to realize that you actually at any point in time are composite of so many different influences,
yeah.
and culture isn't necessarily something that is just stagnant.
Mm. This is a really big issue for Indigenous Australia, isn't it? Or at least the relationship between Indigenous and white Australia. Because
yeah, and the understandings of it. Because,
yeah.
you know, where I come from, Broome is quite unique. We're exempt from the white Australia policy due to the pearling industry. So we had cultural influences of Malay,
yep.
Filipino, Chinese, Japanese. Cultures have been part of our makeup for many generations.
And there was linguistic influence and interplay as well.
Yeah, like I mean, there were luggers full of divers that, you know, you could have a Malay man sitting next to a Yaru man, next to a Japanese man, next to a And so the language that was...
Multicultural Australia.
Yes. Yes, and then, you know, generations like myself have come from that and, you know, it's just one big mixed breed inside me, you know.
Yeah.
And it is a huge question what you asked before, and the way that we process it in our generation now is, I don't think there is an answer. I think the answer is ongoing, and I think it's the future of everywhere because we have access to everywhere now, and we will all be a hybrid at one stage in the future, you know. And
you got no choice.
No, I don't think we'll have a choice in the big future. But it's how do you go forward, bringing the very importance of everything that made, like for me, I have Malay, Filipino, Irish, English, Yaru, Bardi, all these different cultures that make up my heritage.
Do you ever get in touch with your Irish roots?
I tried to tell a few Irish people that I'm an Irishman too.
How did that go down?
They just laughed their head off. So.
It's all about how much you drink on St. Patrick's Day, isn't it? That's my understanding.
Yeah.
You're in the drawing room. That voice you've just heard is Dahlia Pigrams. She's the founding member and co-artistic director of Murugeku. And Fadzai Jaravaza is our other guest, founder of Stillwaters, a storytelling collective for women of African descent. If culture is constantly in evolution, and if the loss of language, for example, means you have a new culture and there's a hybrid there, and this hybridity is always part of human culture, no matter where it is on Earth, can we continue to talk about authenticity in culture? Could you lose language entirely
and still maintain
authentic culture?
That's a very difficult question. I don't know. Without language and language and culture, just they're one in the same. And, you know, we're at the threat of losing our language. We have a handful of elders that fluently speak language.
Mm.
And so it's very near in my future that could be a reality.
Yeah.
But we are doing everything we can to hold on to what we've got and make use of our time with those elders that remain to ensure that it does not die.
Mm.
And, you know, and use the countless amounts of technologies and whatever
systems to
preserve it. And for an oral language to survive over 40,000 years up till now without being written down is a huge achievement.
Indeed,
so,
it's a great irony that it might die out in the very era where everything seems to be preserved.
Yeah.
It's quite extraordinary. Just before I move on from that, have you got any thoughts you want to add on this question? If
that's all? I think it's a really difficult question to answer, that link between culture and language.
And authenticity.
Yeah. I really loved listening to your response, Dahlia. And the reason why I love listening to that response is it made me realise that sometimes that loss is occurring within a larger... There's a larger social... situation, right, where there's been a genocide, basically, a cultural genocide that has occurred, whereas the situation where I'm coming from, it's about people migrating to cities and taking on different ways of being.
But that in itself is a function of colonization.
It's a function of colonization. It's a function of policies that try to address a labor shortage within Southern Africa, so basically trying to get young men into really poorly paid employment in factories, in mines, in commercial farms, and leaving women and young kids and older people out on the reserve. So it was a reserve system pretty similar to what we have in Queensland. In fact, it came from Queensland.
Right.
So what we experience in Southern Africa. But I always, when we're talking about language, because I've got such a fascination with urban music from Africa, and a lot of the music in Zimbabwe, the lyrics will be in Shona, which is, you know, one of the languages we speak in that space. And they're telling the stories of their everyday and daily existence within the city in Shona. And they're hilarious. And I can understand it, but I would never be as eloquent as them because I don't have the grasp of the language like they do. So it's language. It's using the old language to express new reality. So I would say, yeah, it's very important to be able to carry your language with you and for that language and the metaphors within that language to take on new meanings or new shades as things progress and as they go
evolution,
on. Yeah.
Just as you get cultural evolution.
Yeah.
Tell us about Stillwaters.
Well, Stillwaters is this little project that I started in 2011. I always wanted to be a writer, and then I've started writing. But I wanted to do that in the company of other African-descended women because I wanted to write stuff that spoke to an African audience and that rang true for them. So it's that question of authenticity comes up there as well. And I was getting the feeling within myself that I was not able to do that anymore because I wasn't able to speak the truth and the whole truth about my experience because it offended people for whatever reason.
What was offensive about it?
My attempts to be authentic and to speak about the colonial experience would sometimes be interpreted perhaps as being racist or perhaps as being unnecessarily
provocative,
right, as opposed to just telling it like it is or just being curious and asking a question. So I wondered what would happen if I got a bunch of African-descended women together in a room and we could just openly discuss what we were going through in our minds, but never actually had the opportunity to discuss openly.
You created a safe space.
I created a safe space for African-descended women to come and express themselves and explore issues.
A kind of speaker's corner.
A speaker's corner. And then we can take that stuff out now to festivals. So we perform as part of Federation Square's Light and Winter Festival. We've been at the Big West Festival. We've done some theatre stuff with Platform Youth Theatre. And hopefully that sort of stuff will keep growing. But it always starts in a safe space.
Has the reception got better?
It is. It's getting better and it's very warm.
Why? Presumably you're still saying similar things.
We are still saying similar things. And, we have had a few interesting reactions to some of our poetry and performances. But art is supposed to be provocative, I guess. So maybe I'm just becoming comfortable.
What's the best response? Go on.
Oh, I think people are touched. People are deeply touched because, for instance, at the Big West Festival in 2011, we actually put on an alternative Welcome to Country ritual. And this was in collaboration with Auntie Carolyn Briggs from the Boonwurrung Language Group. And we actually came up with that concept by having a discussion with Auntie Carolyn in our safe space. And we found intersections within our languages about, notions of country, notions of belonging, notions of welcome. And we created a piece around that. And we took it out to the West, performed it for an audience of people, very diverse audience. And every single last person was touched.
Mm.
I actually came to the realization that most people in Australia do not feel like they can comfortably claim the title Australian.
Okay, Dahlia, this is surely your turn.
Well, it's an interesting one because I explore through Gurir Gurir, the piece I'm premiering here with Dance Massive, identity a lot, and the feeling that the audience members got at the end was to be left with that question of who am I and what am I doing here and how do I fit in this puzzle or how do I fit in all of this? And I think it's something that I did aim to do because I, through a dialogue with pretty much myself or my own people, I'm trying to put it out there to get people to think about all those times that I've been asked, so where are you originally from? Yeah. Like, where are you actually from? I'm from Broome, Western Australia.
Yeah.
I'm an Australian, but I have all these different heritage,
See, I get asked that question all the time and it annoys me, but you actually got more right to be annoyed than me.
Well, I don't get annoyed. It's just, it's annoying when you're asked it constantly you begin to start to think that you have to prove something.
Because it comes with a doubt. It comes with a suspicion.
Like, oh, well, you're not actually from here, are you?
But what are you really?
Yeah. Yes. That's
the implicit question.
Yeah. And I am what I am. Inside here, from where I come from, connected to the country I was born. That's who I am, So for you as an audience member, this is what I'm thinking as I'm performing. who are you and where do you sit in all of this? You have to make your mind up,
And if you would like to see who Dahlia is, you can, especially if you happen to be in Melbourne. You're performing Gurir Gurir. How do I say it?
Gurir Gurir.
Gurir Gurir. There you go. I don't think that was close. She's just been very nice to me. Anyway, there's it at the Arts House in North Melbourne until Saturday. And Fadzai Jaravaza, founder of Stillwater Storytelling Collective. It's been wonderful having you in the drawing room. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And that's it for me for the week. And Julian Morrow will be in the chair tomorrow, of course, because that's what he does on Friday. He kicks me out of here and makes sure that he gets to take over. Big Ideas is coming up next after the 8 o'clock news. Is Australia too obsessed with food or not enough? Australia's leading chefs, critics and fresh food advocates present their case. It's a smorgasbord of ideas, so stay tuned. Huge thanks to the production team this week. Kerry Dell and Brendan O'Neill on technical production, and then the production team, Ali Benton, Georgia Moody, Barbara Heggan, Melanie Christensen, Ellen Hoffman and Claudette Worden, executive producer Beverly Wang. Back at 6 o'clock Monday. See you then.